Royal Dutch Shell recently unveiled new global warming scenarios in several international forums on the environment. These scenarios modeled three basic variables, pretty obvious ones: energy supply, energy demand, and environmental impact. Shell treats the energy demand variable in these modeled scenarios as more or less a hard reality, something we can't really change, something really more like a constant than a variable. The energy is demanded, of course, by our economy, which continues to churn out a torrent of goods and services for us to consume. The question Royal Dutch Shell is either avoiding or overlooking is why we are not willing to reduce the consumption that drives global warming. I believe there is a spiritual reason for our unwillingness. I believe our voracious consumption of material goods represents a vain, tragic effort to fill a spiritual need that it will never fill: the affirmation of self-worth, which is the first order of business for every human being. Awareness of global warming is generally credited to a wake-up call from a Methodist Sunday school superintendent named Bill McKibben. In 1989, he wrote a book on the subject called The End of Nature. That same year, another insightful writer was trying to send out a wake-up call of his own about how much we consume. Here is the nutshell version of that 1989 wake-up call by Lawrence Shames in a book called The Hunger for More. Consumption without excuses and without the need of justification, the beauty part of it, is that it finesses the irksome question of values and of purpose. Except for unmodern and sentimental reasons, there doesn't have to be a purpose. The mechanism doesn't require it. Consumption keeps the workers working, which keeps the paychecks coming, which keeps the people spending, which keeps inventors inventing and investors investing, which means there is more to consume. The system, properly understood, is independent of values and needs no philosophy to prop it up. It is a perfect circle, complete in itself and empty in the middle. Consumption has proven habit-forming as a way of chasing self-worth. The machinery of our society has become dependent on that level of consumption. In mid-January, the New York Times ran an article entitled "Americans Cut Back Sharply on Spending," in which the writers said, "Strong evidence is emerging that consumer spending, a bulwark against recession over the last year, even as energy prices surged and the housing market sputtered, has begun to slow sharply at every level of the American economy, from the working class to the wealthy. There are mounting anecdotal signs," the writers warned, "that beginning in December, Americans cut back significantly on personal consumption, which accounts for 70% of the economy." A month later, Robert Reich, former Secretary of the Treasury, weighed in on this subject in his own op-ed piece, again in the New York Times, and said, "We're sliding into a recession or worse, and Washington is turning to the normal remedies for economic downturns. But the problem," he said, "lies deeper." What he said was that Americans have completely spent themselves out. The era of this spending is now coming to an end, and consumers have run out of ways to keep the spending binge going that has been running for some three decades now. His recommendation was a new way to keep that spending binge going: a large earned income tax credit financed by a higher marginal income tax on top earners is required, he said. These measures are necessary to give Americans enough buying power to keep the American economy going. The message is clear. We can't afford to consume less. We can't afford to consume less. Now, what kind of crazy world is that to hand over to our children standing here on the verge of adulthood? What are we teaching them by our example? And what are we not teaching them when we look at the world in purely material terms? I say that the Royal Dutch Shell models are fundamentally flawed because they treat addictive consumerism as incurable. And it is bound to look incurable so long as we continue to look at it as a material problem and refuse to see that it is a spiritual problem for which there will only be a spiritual cure. If we did look at it in that spiritual way, we would begin to see that these models leave out a fourth variable, an immense source of energy, in fact. It is the energy that flows through us when we become spiritually conscious. This untapped source of energy is every bit as real as all the energy reserves so carefully plotted in all those elaborate environmental models. Think back. You have been in this spiritual place. You have had a feeling of being energized, of yourself and your world seeming suddenly more capacious, so that everyday frustrations and indignities seem less significant, less of an obstacle to getting on with living. It was a feeling of having connected to a source of life energy and goodness that lies outside of the shifting material circumstances of life. A feeling of breathing it in from somewhere other than the ambient air and then breathing it out into your life. When this feeling came, you and your world were just as beset by vexations as ever. But you glimpsed, at least briefly, the astonishing truth that you and your world are a creature and a creation of incalculable worth. And you didn't need to go out and buy something to prove it. If we could live from this spiritual place, rather than just visiting it in moments of epiphany, I believe this abundant life energy would translate into a radical drop in the material energy toted up in all those environmental models of our future. Material energy going into a hopeless chase after a spiritual end through material means, which will never, ever serve us. Can we live this way? Can we live in that spiritual place and from it? I say yes. This answer is the bequest I want us to hand to those among us who are on the verge of adulthood. This is what it would mean to teach our children well. Will, Audrey, Hunter, the time has come for you to go out into the world just looking for trouble. If in all the advice that will be beamed at you in the next few months, someone says you should stay out of trouble, I say, don't pay any attention to that. The trick is to get into the right kind of trouble. The life-altering, world-altering kind that rages against resignation and refuses to learn not to care so much. You can master that trick. You can. And when you do, you will teach your parents well. Amen.